Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In a time of recession, or maybe worse, it feels like to some recovery from recession and economic belt tightening, the arts can seem impractical, maybe like a frill. But new research is emerging to demonstrate the economic benefit of the arts and the value of creative industries to the life of a community. According to a 2009 study by the Center for Regional Development at Bowling Green State University, creative industries contribute more than $25 billion to Ohio's economy every year. Creative industries support 231,200 jobs in Ohio's economy every year. And creative industries generate a little over $1 billion in state and local tax revenues every year. Later on, we'll get the local story from Milt Bauman. He's the president of the Greater Columbus Arts Council. Joining us now is Rocco Landisman. He's the 10th chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He was nominated by President Obama and confirmed by the U.S. Senate in August 2009. Rocco has produced many Broadway shows, including Angels in America, Perestroika. It's a 1994 Tony Award for Best Play, and also The Producers, which won the 2001 Tony Award for Best Musical. Mr. Landisman has been active on many boards, including the Municipal Arts Society, the Times Square Alliance, the Actors Fund, and the Educational Foundation of America. He's also vigorously engaged the ongoing debate about arts policy, speaking at forums and writing numerous articles. He'll be in Columbus next Monday at a forum, and we'll be talking about that coming up later with Milt Bauman. We'll get information to you about that if you want to attend. Right now, welcome to the show, Rocco.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be on the show.
For the sake of the discussion, how are you defining what a creative industry is?
Well, we're really focusing on the role of artists and arts organizations in a community and how that can transform a place and change a place for the better. We have a term for it at the NEA. We call it creative placemaking.
But what a creative industry is isn't necessarily the ballet and the opera.
No, and it's everybody associated with the arts. It can be not only the actors on stage, but the administrators in the theater, the ushers who work there, the people who are the parking attendants at the parking lot next door, and waiters in the restaurant on the same block. There's a multiplier effect for arts activities through the whole community.
And so when we're talking about that creative industry, you're talking about all of those that are affected by the multiplier effect.
All of the support people involved. There are over 5.5 million arts-related jobs in the United States.
You are visiting Columbus next Monday, as I said, September 19th, for a public conversation at Mershon Auditorium, the OSU Wexner Center for the Arts.
Actually, I'm revisiting. I was there about a year ago, and Okay. Now I'm crawling back.
Hopefully with joy and spring in your step. The title of your conversation is A Way Forward, Arts and Economic Development. The event is free and open to the public, and of course, we'll post a link about that on our website at WOSU.org. You're having conversations like this around the country?
Yes. Very much so. I'm in Charleston, South Carolina now, and we're trying to take this conversation as many places as we can, because we do believe that the arts have a vital role in our economic recovery.
Does the conversation change between regions as you move about the country?
It does. Every city, every region is different. And the map of the arts institutions and organizations is different. Some places may be theater towns. Some places may be more oriented toward music or dance. And there's different degrees of commitment to the arts in different places. Columbus historically has been one of the stronger places.
It ranks sort of in the middle of the pack, though, when I'm looking at some of the rankings of it. There's the 50 City Report called Creative Industries 2008. It kind of ranks, like I said, somewhere in the middle of the pack, and a lot of those maybe a little bit lower middle. But it is one of the 50 largest cities in the country. What do rankings like that mean to, say, somebody who's looking to locate a non-creative industry in the area?
Well, one of the things that we've found, and there's a lot of research on this, is that people don't follow businesses. Businesses follow people. And they go to where there's a committed, educated, engaged workforce. And when people are polled about why they choose a place to live, the arts, along with education, are very, very high on that list of making a place desirable. And so we know if you bring art and artists into the center of town, it attracts the kind of people that businesses want to hire, and ultimately attracts businesses. You know, there's that old expression from Field of Dreams: if you build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of flipping that over and saying, if you come, they will build it. That the people attract the businesses.
My guest is Rocco Landisman. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's going to be with us for about the next 20 minutes. Give us a call if you want to talk to him, 614-292-8513. And to our listeners, do you think public money should be spent on cultural arts? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rocco, as far as looking at what the research is out there about the economic impact of the arts, that's not for the arts community. You already know or are already supporters of the arts. Who is it for?
Of course. It's really for people who are contemplating investment in the arts, and it you know, has to do with what the arts are worth in an economic sense. I mean, I can give you an example. In Columbus, Columbus may be in the middle of the pack in terms of art support, but it's also a kind of poster child for what the arts can do in transforming neighborhoods and communities. The Short North District is a great example of a tough neighborhood that was transformed by the arts. That you know, when you started to have galleries and theater and artists' workspaces and residences, that transforms a place and gives it a completely different character.
When I was looking at those rankings, one of them's it talks about art businesses per 1,000 residents, and it's no surprise that Atlanta, Georgia's up there, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Nashville, Tennessee, all the usual suspects. Is there a correlation there? Aren't they just nice climates? And, you know, Pacific Northwest has a lot going for it that Columbus doesn't geographically. How do you know the arts have the impact they do and that it's not just that the arts are moving to where the people are?
Minneapolis doesn't have a great climate.
That's right.
But it has a great great arts presence. There are a number of cities in Florida, I won't name them publicly, that have great climates without great arts presence. It's interesting. The Knight Foundation, along with Gallup, did a poll about what it is about a community that makes people like to live there, enjoy living there. And everybody thought that at the top of the list would be jobs, schools, et cetera. And that wasn't the case at all. What they said that made people love where they lived, the top three were openness and aesthetic offerings were at the very top of that,
mm-hmm.
Top of that list, and that's the arts.
Oh, when you talk about aesthetic, you're not talking about a mountain view. It's
no,
the arts.
No, aesthetics meaning the arts. You know including how cities are, how they look and how they're designed, which we very much consider part of our portfolio.
Right, when you're talking about...
When people list social offerings, openness, and aesthetics as the top three things that they love about where they live, the arts clearly have a role in that.
And when you're talking about the arts, you're not talking about big, giant museums or huge, monolithic,
We're talking
devotion
about,
to it.
No, we're talking about, for instance, we just made a grant to Columbus as part of our town program here at the NEA, and it's for public art. It's for art along the riverfront, some of it temporary, some of it permanent, that will make people, you know, this will intersect with people who will never go to a performance or to a museum, but they're engaging the arts in their daily lives, and public art touches everyone.
As far as funding for the NEA goes, how is it going? How did the NEA fare in the latest round of budget cuts?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The bad news is that we're taking cuts, And, you know, those are always painful, especially when you have such a limited budget to begin with. The good news is that our cuts are no worse than anyone else's. I can't scream too loud, but, you know, too loudly when my sister agencies on my left and right are taking the same kind of cuts. The arts are not, at least in these recent rounds, being singled out as a whipping boy for cutting spending. We're in the same boat with everybody else, which is you know, that boat is now in shallower water, but at least we're being treated equally.
Today, the NEA and the Ford Foundation announced a new collaboration of foundations and federal agencies to put arts at the center of the revitalization of cities and towns. I think something like what we were talking about a little earlier across the United States by establishing Art Place. The first round of grants from Art Place invests $11.5 million in 34 locally initiated projects, including the recently established Springboard Program of Artworks in Cincinnati. What are you looking for with that kind of funding stream?
This program is really the private sector companion piece to the Our Town program at the NEA that I referred to before that has made a grant in Columbus. This is private sector money put in by foundations, corporations, individuals, and it's our attempt to scale up resources in the field. In this environment, I don't think we can look to congressional appropriation for any big incremental increases. We have to go to where the money is, and the money is in the other federal agencies and in the private sector.
There's also an NEA initiative with the Mayor's Institute on City Design about creative places. And we talked about what creative industries are, and creative places, I think you said the Short North is a good example of that. But creative places change over time. The Short North isn't what it was 20 years ago. For instance, when I first moved to Columbus a couple, 22 years ago, it was a little maybe a little sketchier, a little dicier, a little more exciting, a little edgier. Now it's pretty fancy, pretty upscale. A lot of the lower rent galleries have had to move out. They can't afford the rent anymore.
That is a problem. But if you look at it from the long point of view, it's actually among the happier problems. I remember standing with the mayor of Baltimore in the middle of a very, very tough neighborhood where HUD was building some artist housing. And I said to her, well, what about gentrification? What if this, you know, starts attracting artists and tourists and people get priced out of the neighborhood? And she said, please God, if we could have some gentrification in this neighborhood, it would be a start, because the first thing it does is increase your tax base, increases revenues to the city, and brings back a neighborhood. I think there are ways to deal with the gentrification aspects of it down the road, you know, in terms of subsidy maybe for the artists who live there or whatever. But I think first, in some of these very, very tough neighborhoods, you need to jumpstart their development.
I'm talking with Rocco Landisman. He is the 10th chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Joining us coming up after the break, the president of the Greater Columbus Arts Council. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the 100-watt incandescent light bulb, standard since Thomas Edison days, is on its way out. By law, January 1, we'll look at the light to come. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point begins later this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 52 degrees and cloudy skies in downtown Columbus, gradually becoming mostly sunny today. We'll reach a high of 60 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 45. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 65.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus College of Art and Design, offering continuing education courses to update your creative career skills. Information and online registration are available now at www.ccad.edu.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the arts in the community. What is a creative arts community? What is creative industry? Joining us today, Rocco Landisman. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Rocco, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us now is Milt Boffman. He is president of the Greater Columbus Arts Council. Milt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. Pleased to join you.
Rocco is going to be revisiting Columbus next Monday, September 19th, for a public conversation at Mershon Auditorium, the Wexner Center for the Arts. The title of the conversation, A Way Forward, Arts and Economic Development. The event is free and open to the public. You have to register, though, to go to it. So we'll post a link at our website, and you can check it out there. Our website is wosu.org/allsides.
And you can also get register through the Columbus Partnership's website, columbuspartnership.com. So that's an easy way to do it also if people would like to.
Okay, columbuspartnership.com if you want to register that way. So the description of the event on Monday at the Wexner Center says, please join us in standing up for the arts and express your enthusiasm for the prioritization of the arts in the mainstream planning of the future of our community. You have some, big shots there. Les Wexner is going to be there. And
the mayor.
We'll have the mayor. Oh, yeah, the mayor. Boy.
And Doug Kreidler from the Columbus Foundation. So we're real excited about this panel discussion.
So if you have them there, why does everybody else have to go? Aren't they the kind of people that matter and the rest of the community? Well, they're enthusiastic, but they don't sign the checks.
Oh, I think it's just going to be a really constructive opportunity. Chairman Landisman has a very good view of arts and economic development, and I think in our community that those views are clearly shared. And this will be a real interesting opportunity for this panel discussion, I think, to talk about some of those issues.
Rocco, couldn't the discussion, hypothetically occur in a vacuum and just air it and have people listen to it? How important is it to have the community there listening at the time?
No, I think the exchange is always, in terms of my job, it's what I enjoy the most, is when I get, sharp questions and there's a back and forth and we can really engage people. I think that's the most exciting thing, because that tends to be much more energizing than just listening to something through the media.
And we were talking earlier, Milt, and you listened, about a community like the Short North has reached sort of this point where it's a good problem to have, where there's not enough space that people can afford anymore. It's been gentrified. But at this point in a recession, and Rocco, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, I get the good problem to have, but the bad problem to have is trying to generate the same sort of environment in a new or an area that needs revitalization, and you don't have access to the funds. The funds are thinned out. It's a tough time right now.
It is, but I think we already see developments in the Franklinton area that are really promising for artwork and live space that are just getting off the ground. We see Wonderland developing. They're looking at new venues. The venue they originally chose is not going to work out for them, but I know they're looking at least three or four different sites. And those kinds of developments can help bring the kind of development we've seen in the Short North.
Milt is absolutely right. What tends to happen is that the artists go on to the next underdeveloped neighborhood and transform that one. And I think that's very healthy throughout the entire community.
Has anyone ever looked at just the percentage of artists in the world? Is it or in the country? Does it stay sort of the same percentage? Are there more people that enjoy art now and that participate in it than there were 100 years ago? Rocco, do you have any sense about that?
In the United States, there's about 2 million artists and about 5.5 million arts-related jobs. That number has not changed a lot in recent years.
I think along those same lines, and following up on Rocco had mentioned earlier, the economic linkage with the arts is so important, and the arts organizations in Columbus are certainly sending those messages that in Columbus we have 11,000 people that are employed by arts and cultural organization, and that generates over $330 million for the local economy, and over 6 million people are attracted to events each year in Columbus. So we're very fortunate to have a vibrant and exciting cultural community that's supported by the residents in the community, but also drives economic development.
I saved a press release I received last week from Kappa on the Columbus premiere of Jersey Boys. Yeah. It had a $14 million impact on the local economy. I imagine that's good, or you wouldn't have put out the press release. But do you feel like you constantly have to justify these kinds of events, Milt?
By the way, that's my friend Bill Connor, right?
Exactly. Yes. No, and I don't think – I think those are important messages to send to the community to understand the economic impact that these organizations have in our community. And I think sometimes we don't blow our horn enough or share that kind of information, and it's a good thing to do.
Is that happening around the country, Rocco, that communities, arts communities, are really stepping up the PR?
Yes, and starting to work with each other, which is very important. People need to get out of their silos and start working together. One of the things that artists don't really realize is that they are a political constituency, that they have significant numbers, significant economic impact, and to the extent that they speak with one voice, they have much more influence with politicians, elected officials, and people who have an effect on them.
I asked about the number of artists and people that are devotees of art because the funding for the arts at the most rudimentary level in our public schools is almost non-existent now. Teachers are routinely just buying equipment and supplies themselves for things like that. It's just not considered a priority in our educational process. And Rocco, what are you concerned about? I mean, I'm sure you can say, yeah, of course you're concerned, but what do you do about it? I mean, in the long run, we're living off the intellectual benefit of many years of a lot of arts education in the public schools. Now we've gone about 10 years where it's just been consistently shrinking.
Concerned is an understatement. It's a crisis, in my opinion, and a scandal. Arts are the first thing cut in public schools when there's a budgetary problem, and they should be the last. I think that our current system of basically training teachers to train students to perform on standardized tests in two subjects is pretty short-sighted. I'm starting to call the old program No Test Left Behind. And I think that we need to have a much, much broader view that the kid who has a special passion or talent or idiosyncratic point of view is not necessarily going to perform on standardized tests, but there's a place for him in the world if he's given an opportunity, if he's exposed to arts through arts education. And it's very, very important that we find a role for these kids, and important for our country because of our competitive position is going to be, impacted by the degree to which we're creative and imaginative and innovative. The arts have a critical role to play in that, and I think it's a crime to be cutting arts education. And this is something that we're addressing as best we can with our limited resources. But it's also up, of course, to the states who do most of the education funding.
No buffer?
I think one of the real interesting things that I've seen is what arts organizations in our local community have done in terms of supplementing arts education. And unfortunately, I think this is probably underappreciated because it's a diffused effort. But our larger arts organization had the equivalent of over 900,000 school children enjoyed arts and cultural programming provided by a very diverse group of arts organization. And this programming is in various venues, it's interactive, and very often is curriculum-based. And so arts organizations, I think, bring another element to the community through this extension of their work in arts education, complementing what has been a shrinking arts education program in the public schools.
That's very important, and to the extent that the organizations step up and fill this void, it's fantastic.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the arts and the economy and the relationship between the two with Milt Boffman. He's the president of the Greater Columbus Arts Council, and also Rocco Landisman. He's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. They'll be with us for about 10 more minutes. So if you want to just post your question or comment on Facebook, we can check that out. It's All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. An email from Bob. He says, how do you escape criticism that public funding of the arts as being a hypocritical transfer away from public funding of working class, eating upward to bourgeois enjoyment? Rocco, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, the assumption there is that it's only, you know, so-called upper classes who are engaged with the arts, which I think is nonsense. And one of the interesting trends that I'm seeing everywhere I go is the are initiatives by the arts institutions to get out and around in their communities, not just to expect people to approach these often very forbidding, inaccessible, you know, temples on a hill, but for the art museum to get out and do exhibits in the neighborhood or theaters to do performances around town, arts, you know, music festivals, et cetera. I think we're seeing a lot more engagement with these arts institutions and the public, where the public is, not just expecting them, you know, to come into the institutions. And I think the accessibility of the arts is a big new initiative that's being undertaken everywhere.
Jim, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi. I've lived in the Short North for a number of years now, and I've seen the art scene rise to a great peak. You know, where Gallery Hop was just like, you know, this incredible thing. And now it's declining again because all these criminals have come here from East Columbus to terrorize the neighborhood. So it's really not safe to even walk around outside here at night.
Milt Boffman, if they had left Short North alone and let it just devolve in a different direction, what do you think?
Well, I regret the impression that Jim has, that's not a neighborhood that I am concerned about visiting by any stretch of the imagination. And I still feel that the development that we've seen has been a real contribution to the city. It's continuing to grow as along High Street going north. The Garden Theater is the second oldest theater in Columbus, is going through some renovation now. I think we're always going to see that urban tension around areas that are developing, and we're going to have to work through that with safety officers in the community and residents and business owners.
You know, Rocco, when I was reading up and preparing for this, there's the idea that you want an arts community to be integrated. You don't want just one section. You don't want it to be a clump of buildings somewhere. You want it integrated into a community where there are other kinds of businesses around it. Kind of, there's a checks and balances that way that probably affects safety and those kinds of issues.
Absolutely. The whole point, you know, we're interested at you know, about the intersection of the arts and the real world. And therefore, we're focused a lot on public art. And where you have artistic activity, you're not just attracting artists, you're attracting people in all other fields of employment and engagement. And I think it has a catalytic effect. And yes, we're absolutely interested in the integration of the cultural districts with the rest of the city.
I just want to read this email from Angel that just popped in. She's kind of getting further to the point. Why is it necessary for all the people in a bad neighborhood to move for artists and businesses? A very small fraction, less than 10% of people, cause issues, and the good people who would love to enjoy new artistic neighbors and new businesses have to go off, and that is a problem. And there's a benefit to keeping a nice mixed income neighborhood as well, Milt.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's one of the best benefits, is one that is a mixed neighborhood that provides a quality of life for all the different types of residents we have in the city.
But I suppose that's a challenge for any city, Rocco, right?
Absolutely.
You know, in any event.
I'm seeing this everywhere. You know, it's a living, breathing, evolving thing in every city, and every city manages its neighborhoods in a different way. But we do feel that the arts have a tremendous role to play in bringing up vitality and vibrancy in these places.
Milt Boffman, you've been president at the Greater Columbus Arts Council for a couple years now. I was looking at statistics earlier, mentioned Columbus in the middle of the pack, pretty much, or a little below the middle of the pack from 2008. Do you have any sense about how things have changed since then?
Is there
any way to measure it?
No, I think there's a growing recognition, and there's been a lot of support by the Columbus Foundation and the Columbus Partnership and other leadership in the community to look at our arts and cultural community and to evaluate our funding from both the public sector, the private sector, and other sources of funds to see how we can support the arts community in Columbus in different ways. And I really do feel that there's been some really good work done. The Columbus Foundation and their art sustainability study that was released in January that's on their website has set the groundwork for discussions that are going on right now about looking at different funding options that can help raise the profile and support arts organizations in a way that more aggressively than they are right now.
Rocco, from your point of view, what do you make of Columbus and how it fits into this, you know, national matrix?
Well, I love Columbus, and it's the reason I'm coming back. And one of the things I love about it is what we can how we can showcase the Short North District, whatever the problems of gentrification or crime now or whatever. It's a great success story about how the arts can bring about the revitalization of a neighborhood, and to me, it's a national model, and I want to make a big show of that whenever I can.
Rocco, at one time or another, you've owned three minor league baseball teams, among other things. But what's the and right now, professional sports is on the minds of a lot of folks because the city and county are looking at a proposal to buy the big nationwide arena in order to keep the Columbus Blue Jackets hockey team in town. There's controversy about that among a lot of people that aren't necessarily interested in hockey. I was wondering, from your perspective, what the relationship is between economic development potential of professional sports and the arts. Are they mutually exclusive, mutually misunderstood, mutually beneficial? Where does that fall for you?
They're certainly not mutually exclusive. And I'm sure the people who are advocating for the arena for the Blue Jackets have all kinds of statistics about employment and economic activity, and I'll leave that to them. But what I will address is that what we encounter again and again is that one of the most important metrics is how people feel about where they live. That has to do with cities retaining their population and attracting a workforce and businesses. And sports, like the arts, have to do with how people feel about where they live. And not everybody has to love hockey. Not everybody has to love parks. Not everybody has to love the arts. But in the aggregate, the more assets a community has, the more people like living there or want to move there. And I think that's very important.
Ben in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm on the board of a small 501c3 arts organization, a theater, Columbus Civic Theater here in town. And, you know, we don't get the kind of recognition or press that the big organizations do that contribute to economic activity that you can point to, they brought in $5 million, blah, blah, blah. How do we get our mission known and out there and get, get on the map and show that we're having an impact, that we could have an impact locally? Our theater, there's no businesses near it. It would be great to have a restaurant, for example, that people could go to after a show. But we're sort of one of the many small arts organizations out there that's just struggling to be on the map at all. We get support from the Greater Columbus Arts Council. Thank you very much, Milt. But we're trying to do good work for people in the arts, but, you know, we're too small to be recognized.
Yeah, how important are the small guys, Rocco?
Well, I first of all love that you have a theater because I'm a theater person. So I have a special feeling for that. But I mean, Milt, can you address how the smaller organizations are dealt with?
Thank you. And Ben, Columbus Civic Theater is a great example. Up on Indianola, where they took what had been a gas station and converted it into, I think, a 49-seat theater. It's a terrific space, and they've got a real strong company around that. And they've really tried to build a grassroots following in the Clintonville area. One of the things that we do at GCAC as part of our contract with the City of Columbus is we have a website, columbusarts.com, which is a registry of events going on. And I know we've got Columbus Civic Theater in there. And the other element I think that's important is that at GCAC, we see an important role of ours is to try to help these smaller organizations. We're always going to be there for the large ones, but we think we've got to help smaller organizations where, frankly, those in some what might be thought of as limited dollars, but they do make a big impact, and we're real pleased to be able to try to support those. And we're going to try to put more emphasis around smaller organizations and how we can help market them and help promote their programming.
Milt Boffman, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Milt Boffman, he's president of the Greater Columbus Arts Council. Also, Rocco Landisman, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Rocco is the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He'll be in Columbus next Monday, September 19th, at the Mershon. He will be talking about the arts and the economy. It brings together the also with him is will be Mayor Coleman, Leslie Wexner, Doug Kreidler of the Columbus Foundation to talk about the value of the creative sector in building attractive and competitive cities. You can go to WLSU.org to get some links on how to register for that free event. Coming up, the birds. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and beginning at 11 o'clock, join us for Hour 2 of All Sides, the Blue Jackets and the purchase of Nationwide Arena. That discussion will begin at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
State Auto Insurance has supported the quality programming on WOSU for over 30 years and is now proud to support the Columbus Neighborhoods Project. It's a neighborhood as active and complex as the institution it embraces, Columbus's University District, where town meets gown. Do they stand shoulder to shoulder or toe to toe? Learn more about this vibrant, exciting neighborhood when WOSU-TV presents Columbus Neighborhoods, the University District, airing Thursday, October 6th at 8 p.m.
And be sure to discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher on our website, WOSU.org/allsides. On the show's website, you can listen and watch the show live every day from 10 until noon and participate in the show through our live chat. That's WOSU.org/allsides. Gradually becoming mostly sunny today. Right now, cloudy skies and 52 degrees. Expect a high of 60 this afternoon. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 45. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's that special time of year again, the fall migration of birds to their winter nesting places. To celebrate and observe, you could join the 2011 Midwest Birding Symposium this weekend at Lakeside, Ohio. If you can't make that, then this is your lucky day. Bill Thompson III, the editor of Birdwatchers Digest, one of the sponsors of the symposium, is calling us from Lakeside right now with a preview and some bird sounds. Welcome back, Bill.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be here again.
So you're at Lakeside right now, the south shore of Lake Erie, at the 2011 Midwest Birding Symposium. It begins today. It goes through Sunday. What goes on at the symposium?
Well, the symposium is an every other year event for birdwatchers, and it's really sort of like the gathering of the clans, if you will, almost like a Woodstock for bird people. You know, the birding is great up here this time of year, but what we do here at Lakeside, because it's so charming and beautiful and everybody's walking around the campus, it's almost like going to bird camp. And we have a lot of seminars that people attend. We have, I think, close to 30 different speakers over the next 3 days. And so we bird watch a little bit in the morning, and then we have sessions through the late morning and afternoon. We got a big vendor area. And, of course, being up here right on the lake, we catch a lot of the birds as soon as they cross the lake from Canada and hit the tall trees here at Lakeside. We're ready for them with our binoculars.
What happens at those big venues of the big bird watching events to the birds? I mean, having that many people around, doesn't that sort of scare them off?
Well, you know, that's a subject of some debate. In the spring, when the birds are headed north and they sort of pile up at the little bits of habitat left along the southern Lake Erie shore, like McGee Marsh,
right.
You know, I think the various metro parks and the Fish and Wildlife and the Ohio Division of Wildlife, they've sort of tried to manage the really good places for bird and wildlife watching so that the people can observe the birds or the wildlife without really disturbing it. So, for example, at McGee Marsh, there's a boardwalk that's built out through the woods that you can walk along quietly, and the birds are all around you. But, you know, what we do, we've got six or seven different birding sites that people drive to or carpool to on their own. And we have guides there that sort of informally take groups as they arrive, when it's very casual birding. And so we're not racing around shouting and pointing and, you know, screaming, although I'm sure people will be excited. But, yeah, so, we bird watchers really care about the birds first and foremost.
You call the Midwest Birding Symposium the world's friendliest birding event.
That's right.
How so?
Well, you know, when I started out as a bird watcher back in the early 70s, we weren't this established community. And bird watching was still sort of Miss Jane Hathaway from the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, or the crazy old ornithologist from the Byrds, and wasn't really socially acceptable. And so bird watchers were kind of shy about admitting their hobby. You know, bird watchers were thought to be dotty old professors with pith helmets and stuff. Now, when all these products are available everywhere, feeders, seed, binoculars, field guides, all this information online, we're very well connected as a community. So we want a lot of new people to come and join the ranks of bird watchers. And so we try to engage people who are brand new, who maybe want to stick a toe in to bird watching to see if they like it. Because it's almost impossible to think of another avocation that is as engaging to sort of mind, body, and spirit as bird watching. And of course, we love the social aspects of it. So tonight there'll be 250 people getting on a boat here and taking a sunset boat cruise around the island. So then they'll be having a good time looking at birds, talking, catching up. So, you know, it's just a very social event, and we welcome any newcomers.
My guest is Bill Thompson III. He's the editor of Birdwatchers Digest. He's talking to us from Lakeside, Ohio, on the south shore of Lake Erie at the 2011 Midwest Birding Symposium. Begins today and continues through Sunday. If you have a question or comment for Bill, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The bird sound that we had at the top of the hour, you might, if you can remember back, it was the rose-breasted grosbeak, mm-hmm. a very pretty-sounding bird, I might add. Tell us about the rose-breasted grosbeak.
Well, the rose-breasted grosbeaks nest sort of across the northern tier of Ohio and on up. They're kind of a bird of the deciduous, northern deciduous woods, so they love oaks and tulip poplar trees and stuff. Down where I live in southeast Ohio, we don't have them nesting, but they come through every year. And every year our phone rings at Birdwatchers Digest with a call. I've got this bird. It's beautiful. It's black and white, and it's got like a pink scarf on its chest. What is it? I've never seen it before. Well, that's the rose-breasted grosbeaks are coming back through. They spend the winter in, you know, Central America, and they come back through in the north, headed north to breed, and they stop at bird feeders and eat sunflower seed on the way. Now, during the rest of the year, they might be eating fruit or seeds or insects, but in the spring, they tap into that easy food source of people's bird feeders. So in the fall now, the rose breasts don't sing so much that beautiful song that you heard. They have this little eek call that sounds almost like a tennis shoe on a squeaky gym floor.
Yep.
And when they give that, which they do a lot in fall migration, that's usually your first clue that there's a rose-breasted grosbeak around.
It's funny, when you put it that way and describe the sound that way, it sounds, I don't know, but when you actually know it's a bird,
right.
not
right.
a tennis shoe on a gym floor, it's better. We're going to listen now to the logo bird for the 2011 Midwest Birding Symposium, and for our listeners out there, see if you know what it is. Bill Thompson?
Well, you know, I don't know if on my phone line, I could just hear the highest pitched part of that, but I believe that was a Caspian tern.
It was.
Yeah, so I hope everybody else out there listening in Radioland got to hear it. The Caspian tern is the largest of the terns that we have here nesting on the Great Lakes, and the big bird with the honking big orange bill and a shaggy black crest, and they look like gulls that have had a makeover. You know, they're a little bit more sleek and beautiful looking and kind of exciting looking. And when I got here to Lakeside on Monday to start setting up, there were three Caspian terns out at the end of the Lakeside Pier, and I took that as a very good omen.
Let's hear another sound. Again, it's fun to just listen to it first and then have people try to figure out what it is.
Right.
This sounds like a giggling girl, I'm told. That girl scares me.
I bet nobody can figure out what that is.
I wouldn't have known.
Yeah, because whenever you see this bird portrayed on car commercials or in movies, the sound that they play is, which is a red-tailed hawk screaming.
Okay.
But that's actually the call of our national symbol, the bald eagle. And I think it's one of the reasons Ben Franklin was rooting for the turkey to be our national symbol, because at least it had a manly kind of call. Whereas the bald eagle, this beautiful, you know, fierce-looking, white-headed, white-tailed, regal bird, has that little giggling girl call. It's one of nature's cruel jokes.
It's like the Milli Vanilli of...
Exactly. Except he's not lip-syncing.
That is the bald eagle. Sounds like a giggling girl if you hear one. Take a look around. Next is, it's a red bird. Let's hear. What is that, Bill?
I think that's the scarlet tanager, isn't
it? That's right, yep.
Yeah, there will be a lot of scarlet tanagers coming through Ohio in the next... There have been for the last few weeks, and there will be for the next few weeks. But they've lost their beautiful red color. Most of them have already molted or are starting to molt into their drabber winter plumage, which is the color of basically the foliage in the Central America where they're going to spend the winter.
Well, what color's that?
It's sort of an olivey drab yellow-green. So the males really start looking more like the females in fall, and they spend the winter that way. And then when they come back in the spring, they're the bright scarlet with the black wings that we know and love as one of our great woodland birds in Ohio.
How common is it that a bird molts like that and actually changes colors for the season? I know there's the yellow finch.
Yeah, the goldfinch does that.
Oh, the goldfinch, right.
Yeah, it's fairly common, but not all birds change color. All birds molt. Because it's sort of like when your clothes wear out, you got to get new clothes. And birds do that. Some birds do that a couple of times a year. But most birds do molt. And a lot of our songbirds, beautifully colored songbirds, many of our warblers, some of our orioles, the scarlet tanager, they are so brilliantly colored in the summer, in the spring and summer, to attract a mate and to be visible for their rivals, their territorial rivals. And then they change into the drab colors because they really don't need that sort of visual stimulation or visual clues in the winter and fall. So they change into the drabber colors, and it helps them survive more because they're not so noticeable for predators. But a lot of our songbirds do that. Not all of them. You know, things like song sparrow, cardinal, chickadee, titmice, the white-breasted nuthatch, the very common backyard birds, they molt once or twice a year, but they don't change color.
My guest is Bill Thompson III. He's editor of Birdwatchers Digest. If you have a question or comment for Bill, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We still have a few minutes if you want to take a stab at that, or maybe you could try the Facebook. Might be a fast way to contact us with questions or comments. So is the Great Migration in the fall, Bill, just the reverse of the Great Migration in the spring? Or are they different?
Well, they are different, Ann. You know, we don't get the same birds through that we get in the fall that we get in the spring. For example, for years, I was the laughingstock of all my birding friends in Ohio because I hadn't seen a Connecticut warbler. And Connecticut warblers spend the winter in the tropics. They come up through sort of the central part of the U.S., in spring, in late May, like right around Memorial Day, they're streaming through. And my friends from Columbus would say, we're at Greenlawn Cemetery. We've got three Connecticut warblers. Ha, ha, ha. I'd never seen one. It took me 20 years to finally see one because in the fall, they go out and down the East Coast. So, you know, the Connecticut warblers do that. Black pole warblers do that. They kind of have a circular migration where they come north up through the middle of the country and go south, in some cases, like the black pole warbler. They go straight east from the boreal forest in the far north. They go straight east and fly out over the ocean all the way down until they finally hit landfall on the northern part of South America. So I don't really know the reason for that, but maybe it has to do with prevailing winds and sort of historical weather patterns. But we don't get all the same birds in the fall that we get in the spring.
So also, are the days shorter? Or is there a difference in the weather necessarily? Or because I'm trying to remember back to the spring what the weather's. Yeah. It's not necessarily worse or better.
No, it's not. You know, but when a front comes through in the spring, when a warm front comes through from the south, kind of bubbling up, birds will follow it. They'll ride it. In the fall, when we get a nice cold front like we got here last night, boy, the birds are really moving because they sense that that cold front. They want to take advantage of the prevailing winds, and it kind of gives them yet another bit of stimulation to move south.
So they're not hanging around. They're not as easy to catch.
Well, they're not as easy to see, but, you know, the thing is, if you're lucky and you're in a good piece of habitat on a morning like this, or tomorrow morning should be especially good after this cold front's moved through, just get out there and wait, and you'll see that there will be lots of bird activity. Thrushes, warblers moving through, vireos, tanagers, orioles, all these things are flooding through Ohio right now.
Let's listen to one more bird because we have to go soon.
Okay.
What's that, Bill?
I couldn't really hear it.
Okay.
That must be was it a robin?
It was the indigo bunting.
It was the indigo bunting. Okay. Well, and indigo buntings are flying through right now. It's another bird, beautiful blue. The males are beautiful blue in spring. In the fall, they're very sort of brownish drab. But you can hear them giving this little call. That's a really good clue that you've got indigo buntings migrating through.
Bill Thompson, what are you looking forward to seeing this time around?
Well, I'm hoping to catch a little wave of migration tomorrow morning, and we're dedicating the new Lake Erie Birding Trail tomorrow with some of the folks from the Division of Wildlife. So we're going to be out at East Harbor State Park tomorrow, I think at 9:30, and we're hoping to catch some warblers. Last 2 years ago when we had the symposium here, we had a Kirtland's warbler there, which is perhaps our rarest North American warbler. So if we're really lucky, we'll see that bird again tomorrow.
Okay, well, Bill Thompson, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
And it's always a big thrill talking to you. Thanks so much.
Bill Thompson, the 30s editor of Birdwatchers Digest. He was talking to us from Lakeside, Ohio, on the south shore of Lake Erie at the 2011 Midwest Birding Symposium. It begins today and continues through Sunday, September 18th. You can go to our website if you want to get to a link and get more information about that at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.